From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On President Trump's calendar today, a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Back at home, Netanyahu is fighting off three separate corruption charges. And President Trump began the week with tweets about those proposed new tariffs on steel and aluminum, as many in his own party slammed the idea. Then there was last week's drama in the White House with reports of an angry Trump wandering increasingly empty halls. Let's bring in NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
And start with Netanyahu. Today he praised Trump for the decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. That infuriated Palestinians, of course. But what does it mean for these talks that Netanyahu is in hot water in his own country? What else might they want to talk about?
Well, probably not the temperature of the water, as you say. That's not a favorite topic for either man. Netanyahu's been accused of having an aide bribe a judge in a case that involves Netanyahu's wife. And he's also accused of smiling on certain regulatory requests by a powerful Israeli telecom company. And look, there are a lot of problems for Donald Trump with respect to the Mueller investigation back in this country. But they have a lot of happier topics to talk about. They can talk about their cooperation with respect to Syria and Iran. Possibly Russia. They can talk a little bit about all of the concerns that both countries have with those situations. And we surely expect the prime minister to congratulate President Trump on moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem earlier than anyone expected. The president had said today that he might actually try to attend the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. And this, as you say, amounts to an endorsement of Netanyahu's formula for peace in the region, which is a peace of dictated terms rather than the old two-state solution that presidents had been supporting in both parties for many years.
Okay, so a lot going on there. But we want to ask you about the New York Times report yesterday that Congress allocated $120 million to the State Department to fight Russian meddling in U.S. elections. But the State Department hasn't spent a single penny to do that. Why not? What does this say about Rex Tillerson?
Well, it says a lot about his predicament as well, perhaps, as his leadership. Congress has given him this money to fight something that President Trump doesn't much like to talk about, which is the Russian meddling in the last election and in the next election. So if it's something that the president says maybe only happened in the past and won't happen again, it's a little uncomfortable for his cabinet members to go out and start spending a lot of money to prevent it or to act as though it's already going on. And what's more, Rex Tillerson himself has said he isn't sure that there's anything his department can do, even if it is happening and even if it wants to do something about it. And he has put a lot of priority on letting a lot of positions go empty to save money.
Look, the proposed steel and aluminum tariffs, Trump is insisting on them. Today, House Speaker Paul Ryan's office said Ryan is urging the White House to not advance with this plan. Yesterday, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham put it this way on CBS's Face the Nation.
China is winning and we're losing with this tariff regime. You're letting China off the hook. You're punishing the American consumer and our allies. You're making a huge mistake here. Go after China, not the rest of the world.
Punishing allies like Canada, Brazil, others that also sell aluminum and steel to the U.S. who will also have these tariffs on that. But, Ron, I just have to ask, what is the outrage here? This is the Donald Trump who campaigned on this very pledge of tariffs.
Precisely. And this is one of those areas where the president needs to be taken at his word. He has for 30 years been talking about what he sees as an uneven playing field for trade for the United States. He has had various and sundry economic reasons to do so. Now he has had political reasons to do so. And he's carrying through on another one of the things that he not only promised, but that he sees as an essential connection between himself and his most loyal voters. So no one should be surprised that he's doing this.
We just have a minute left. What's your sense of the White House and the Oval Office this week? After last week, you had the exits from his inner circle, senior advisor Hope Hicks. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, lost his temporary security clearance. There's reports of an almost Shakespearean tone, you know, the president angrily wandering the halls. What's your sense?
Some of this, perhaps, is driven by anxiety about Robert Mueller, the special counsel, and his investigation, and all of the areas that it's getting into, both of things that happened since the president took office and things that his family may have been up to over a number of years going back and involving perhaps Russian money. And all of that is upsetting to the president and upsetting to some of the people around him. But there's also this sense of the president liking a kind of chaotic atmosphere in which to operate. So much of this is his doing, and I suppose in the end, and it may be his undoing as well.
Well, we sort of have to wait and see whether, you know, he ran as a disruptor. there's a thin line between disruption and something unraveling, and we don't yet know where we are. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
In Syria today, a convoy of 46 aid trucks crossed into the region of eastern Ghouta. The area has been under siege by Syrian government forces for months, but fighting has escalated in the past 2 weeks. More than 600 have died. The convoy is expected to bring in desperately needed food and medical aid, but according to the World Health Organization, Syrian authorities rejected many of the supplies, including trauma and surgical kits. Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and writes the blog Syria Comment. He's on a Skype line. Josh, welcome back.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, we've known that people are in desperate need of supplies in this area. The last convoy came on February 14th with assistance for just 7,000 people. Remind us the need in eastern Ghouta right now.
Well, it's tremendous. This is an area, a big suburb of a farming suburb with lots of villages and towns in it. It revolted against the regime early on in this long-going civil war. It's been surrounded for a long time. There were trenches and tunnels dug underneath, and through corruption and various other things, trade went on. But those were closed recently by the regime that has blown them up and is trying to take back this region. It's bombing it, it's sending in mortars and cannon fire, and its best troops are now pushing in on two sides, trying to cut this large area in two. So that's the desperate situation. People are starving and they're being bombed.
And this area is key to the Syrian government because this is where one of the last holdouts of rebels this close to the capital, Damascus, is. Is that right?
Absolutely. And the rebels can send mortar fire into the middle of Damascus, which they do, and have killed quite a few people. Nothing on the scale to what the regime is doing to the rebels. But the regime is on the verge of winning a war, taking back much of this rebel-conquered territory, and this is the most important part, right next to the city.
Now, back to this convoy. The World Health Organization says that Syrian authorities removed as much as 70% of the medical supplies. We're talking surgical kits, insulin. Why in the world would they do that?
Well, they want these people to give up and surrender. They believe that the international community is trying to delay that surrender. And they use the argument that when the United States was bombing Raqqa, the capital of ISIS, the international community and health and humanitarian organizations all asked for a pause in the fighting so that they could send in humanitarian supplies. America said, no, we're finishing this off. We can't dither around. And that's the attitude of the Syrian regime. They have said, we want all sick people and people who want help to come to a certain passageways where they can go and get help from the Red Crescent and other Syrian humanitarian organizations. And they don't want the UN to go in and deliver goods to them. And so they've robbed these caravans that are going in.
Well, it seems significant that the Syrian government would even acknowledge that there were sick people trying to get out of this city because Bashar al-Assad has told state news outlets that descriptions of the humanitarian situation there are a ridiculous lie. Russians at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva have said that media descriptions are saturated with lies. You know, for the record, is there any truth to that?
The humanitarian situation in this region of the eastern Ghouta is terrible. You know, have rebel groups been sending out lots of videotapes that some could be fixed in some way or staged? That's very possible. But the underlying point here is that there is tremendous human misery going on in a terrible killing field.
You mentioned that the Syrian government is on the verge of winning this war. We're about 7 years into it now. Where's this going?
You know, for a long time, the coalition had asked for there to be deconfliction zones and that they concentrate like a laser beam on killing ISIS and destroying ISIS. For some time, that helped because there were deconfliction zones. Eastern Ghouta was one of them. As soon as ISIS was destroyed, all bets were off on these deconfliction zones, and the regime started to try to capture as many of them as it could. The Syrian regime is occupying about 60% of the territory of Syria. The United States with its partners, the PYD, or the Syrian Democratic Forces, as it calls them, largely Kurds, has conquered about 30% of Syria, northern Syria. It has 50% of oil and gas in it and much of the Syria's water and agricultural resources. Turkey is taking another 10%. Afrin now, there's an invasion going on where it's conquering this Kurdish territory, but it has other territories in the north along its border with Syria. So Syria is likely to be divided into three zones, an American Kurdish zone, a Turkish Arab rebel zone, and a Syrian government zone backed by Russia and Iran.
That's Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes the blog Syria Comment. Josh, thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Dame Helen Mirren graced the Oscars last night and didn't let her royal title get in the way of a Vanna White turn on the jet ski. Host Jimmy Kimmel offered to the Oscar winner with the shortest speech, which, by the way, was Phantom Thread's costume designer Mark Bridges, at 30 seconds. On a more serious note, Mirren joined Jane Fonda to present the Oscar to Gary Oldman for Best Performance by a Leading Actor.
From the 1960s to the present, we have both witnessed and experienced so many changes in politics, in fashion, in film, in science, technology, and now between women and men, in public and in private.
Dame Helen's Oscar is for her Queen Elizabeth II in The Queen. She also won a Tony for her Queen Elizabeth in the Broadway play The Audience. Her latest film, The Leisure Seeker, opens Friday. She plays Ella Spencer, the Southern-born wife of former New England college professor John, played by Donald Sutherland, his mind slowly being lost to dementia.
You know, I start a sentence, mm-hmm. and by the time I get to the end of it...
Mm-hmm. Can't remember how it started.
Ella, we learn, is facing cancer, but they ditch the adult children and embark on a road trip in a dilapidated old Winnebago nicknamed the Leisure Seeker, driving from Massachusetts to Florida to see the home of Ernest Hemingway. There are grand comedic escapes from disaster, as in any road trip film, but this one is also an often heart-sinking look at a decades-long adoring marriage as it's attacked from within. The film, The Leisure Seeker, is Italian director Paolo Verzi's English-language debut. We asked Helen Mirren what drew her to it.
Well, you just said two of the names, Paolo Verzi and Donald Sutherland. Mm-hmm. I did do a film with Donald a long time ago.
You played husband and wife.
An earlier version, I guess, of Ella and John. But we didn't actually have a lot of scenes together in that film. So I thought an actor of Donald's stature and caliber, it would be wonderful to have a film where I'm basically on screen with him for the whole film. It's a two-hander, the film.
By the way, the 1990s film was Bethune, The Making of a Hero. But what drew you to Ella? I often ask actors who are approaching these characters who are later in life and facing the end of life, and you sometimes think, well, maybe you'd want to run away from that.
Yes, and I have to say that I said to my agent, because as you do get older in life, people think the only films that you really can do are films about cancer and Alzheimer's. Mm. So I said, I do not want any films about Alzheimer's or anyone dying of anything. Mm-hmm. And then this script arrives, which has got them both in it. But it was such a beautiful script. It was so sweet and funny. And it is, it's a love story. It's what happens after they lived happily ever after.
Right.
And I think above all, it's a love story.
It is, as you say, after the happily ever after, because it's strained. Anyone living with someone with Alzheimer's dementia knows that. Here's a scene in which John and Ella encounter Jenny, one of John's former students, and he remembers her perfectly.
I mean, you can't remember the names of your own kids, but you do remember that Jenny was always laughing. I'm speechless. I mean, what goes on in that head of yours?
She was such a good student.
Oh, well, that explains it all.
Frustration. And that's just a lighter. There are, of course, moments where it's explosive. Her anger that he's leaving by losing his memory and his mind.
Yes.
Did you research dementia? Do you know someone with it? What did you bring to that?
No, I didn't. I just read the page, you know, imagined the situation. I guess I over the years I've gathered certain elements, but I felt that the realities of the situation were dealt with pretty well in the script. It's probably quite a benign look at the situation, but that's the nature of the film, you know.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, Ella, again, they adore each other. And there's a moment where she finds out that he had a long ago affair.
Oh, no. I mean, in terms of the relationship and the betrayals, the anger about the betrayals, the fact that you imagine that you don't really fully know anyone is a reality of relationships. But that's about the relationship, not particularly about the Alzheimer's.
Right,
That's about a long marriage, which, you know, if he didn't have Alzheimer's, he probably would never have revealed to her. But because of his problem, you know, it comes out, you know.
He mistakes her for his former lover.
He mistakes her for his former lover, exactly.
That's crushing.
You know, it's, you know, painful but comedic. And and that's the great quality of the film. It has this very gentle comedic look at painful things.
Yeah. Just because we can, we're speaking with you, we have to ask, Queen Elizabeth twice. Do you see yourself taking on other royal characters, or is that something you'd avoid?
I wouldn't play the Queen of England, the present Elizabeth Windsor, as I call her, again, because I've done that twice in two different circumstances.
Right.
You know, the play was very different from the film. And luckily, other people are taking on the ermine in my place and beautifully well. And thanks to the series The Crown. So that's liberated me from that one.
What did it mean to you to play that role?
Well, when I did it, no one had thought of doing that. You'd had the royal family being mercilessly mocked on satirical television in England. But no one had ever thought of doing a serious drama about them because they're still alive. You know, there's something, and no one had ever, just hadn't thought of doing that, you know, and all the fact you could do it. So I knew when I did the film, it was going to get an awful lot of attention. The British have a very ambivalent love-hate relationship with the royal family, with the monarchy in general. So I knew they'd be all over it, and I had to be very, very careful.
Get it right.
Get it right as far as possible, and also get it right as far as I was concerned, because I liberated myself. I was very anxious about doing it, and I liberated myself by realizing that the Queen has had many portraits painted of her, and realizing that I was just painting another portrait, and that in that portrait, as with the painted portraits, there's as much of the artist's understanding of her as there is of her herself. It's just a portrait, but it's my portrait of what I believe is what I see in her.
Huh. Just touch on, again, since we have you, the biggest talk of your industry right now, the sexual harassment in Hollywood. You've worked on both sides of the pond. Is something like this happening in Britain?
I can only imagine the answer to that is yes, because it seems to me it's happening everywhere, and not just in my business, but in every profession. But if someone had asked me, I don't know, 6 months ago, what about the casting couch in Hollywood? I would have said absolutely, genuinely, it doesn't exist anymore. That's a thing of the past. I was so unbelievably ignorant and wrong about that. And it was my blindness to the fact that this is obviously a constant that's with us all the time. The reality is that you are only exposed to it as a woman, and probably as a boy as well, incidentally, between the ages of 15 and 25. When I was that age, I was in England, and I was an actress, but I wasn't, you know, out in that way. I was working in Shakespeare. It was slightly different. But what did happen to me was that men exposed themselves to me constantly, every week. I'd have someone exposing on the underground, on the subway, walking down the street. It almost happened to me once a week.
Really?
And absolutely, absolutely. Huh. Until I was about 24, when it stopped. So it's all to do with your age. It's all to do with that very young, that window of youth.
Well, that's sexual harassment, sexual assault of the eyes at the very least, and of the sensibilities. Mm. But you, later in life, became quite a sex symbol. You are still now a very young 72. But circling back to The Leisure Seeker, the new film, you've said that one of the things that attracted you to Ella, the character, is how she is facing the end of her life.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
With liveliness, I guess. I mean, the lovely thing about Ella's character is she's very lively. She's very communicative. She wants to chat to people, you know. She wants to find out about other people. She's curious about life. She's not. She hasn't withdrawn from life. And that was really what I found very charming in the character, especially when you consider the decision that she makes. But, you know, this is not someone withdrawing from life. This is someone rushing headlong into life.
One last question. We're seeing some early reviews, people loving this relationship you have with Donald Sutherland on film, but in some cases not warming up to this notion. And I'm wondering if, as I was watching it and sobbing at the end, I'm wondering if it's hard. We don't like to see that people who've become iconic to us, maybe even stand-ins for parents, you, Donald Sutherland, we don't like such a clear-eyed look at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? It's a part of life. It's as much a part of life as being born is, you know. The minute you're born, that's on the menu. I always say, you either die young or you get old, you know. There's no two ways about it. And coming to terms with that and understanding that, and it is a part of the process of life. But you can only understand or realize that as you pass through life yourself.
That's Dame Helen Mirren, her latest film, The Leisure Seeker. Dame Helen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
In February, the tax cuts that Congress passed in December began appearing in workers' paychecks, but you may not have noticed. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off, has taken a look. Jill, not everyone noticing, but first start with, is everyone getting a little more?
Well, not every single person, but according to the Treasury Department and the IRS, they had estimated back in January when they changed some of the withholding tables that nearly 90% of workers would actually have some increase. So maybe you have. It's just a question of how much.
Okay. And if you notice it, because I'm reading a bank rate, which, you know, the researchers who do surveys, they say of those they talk to, 24% of workers attributed a slight increase in pay to the federal tax law, but just 41% were aware of any change at all. 42% said they didn't see any difference. 12% said they couldn't say one way or the other. So who is getting a bump?
Well, I think that's important because, again, the estimates were from the Tax Policy Center that the average taxpayer would have a $1,600 reduction in 2018 in the amount of taxes they would pay. So that means that your after-tax pay would go up. But of course, most of the savings is going to the nation's highest earners. So if you look at the middle, and that's defined as households earning, individuals earning $48,000 to $86,000, those folks should have an estimated $930. Okay, that sounds like a good chunk of money, right? It's $36 if you get paid biweekly, and maybe because it's not that much money for every single paycheck, maybe that explains some of those bank rate results because, you know, $36 in a paycheck, you don't really necessarily notice it, especially if you're getting that direct deposit every other week.
Right. Well, there are tables so you can check. And look, $36 every couple of weeks for, you know, that doesn't hurt, you know. So the other advice is, you know, see if you're getting it. But if you are getting it, make sure it goes to something like paying off debt or to saving. You shouldn't be thinking, hey, I got a lot of money, I'm going to go out and spend it on stuff.
Right. I mean, that's the problem when it's a small amount, is that it's sort of like you don't really think I'm going to capture this. But the certified financial planner in me must remind you that if we can automate it, that's great. So what's the first thing you want to do? You say, okay, I got to try to put this on autopilot. So maybe you just instruct your bank, pull a certain amount of money from my checking account, put it into my savings account. Let me get that emergency reserve up. Maybe you then say to your credit card company, if you're carrying a balance, pull a certain money out of that checking account, pay off that debt. If you're saving for retirement, this is a perfect time to capture that money. You're going to get a little help from Uncle Sam to save for retirement. You're going to help reduce your tax liability for next year. And don't forget, a lot of retirement plans, they have these wonderful features where you can automatically increase your contribution every year. So maybe you bump it up a little bit now and then say, do another 1% next year. Yeah,
I loved how you just said in passing, and put it into your emergency reserve fund, which a lot of people probably went, of which I do not have.
Uh-huh.
That you're supposed to have, what, like 3 months in that you would need to spend in an emergency account.
Well, that would be if you are sort of even on the edge. I would suggest, again, because I must look at the worst case scenario constantly, 6 months of your expenses. I'm sorry. You never know when something weird or bad is going to happen. Please just try to do it. It can prevent you from doing some really dopey things.
Jill Schlesinger of CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
Don't do dopey things.
President Trump said today he will not back down on his plan to hike tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, despite growing pressure from members of his own party. Politicians and economists are talking about a potential trade war. President Trump says he doesn't think there will be one, but there could be. It's happened before. Let's bring in Chad Bown. He's senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and host of the weekly podcast Trade Talks. Chad, welcome. And I keep hearing that the last time the United States was in a major trade war, it was 1930, and Congress triggered it with something called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. What was that?
So the Smoot-Hawley Tariff was a broad-based set of import restrictions that the United States imposed in the 1930s. Now, it's often confounded with the Great Depression, but there's a couple of things that are worth clarifying. These tariffs didn't cause the Great Depression. They were actually set up in legislation that was established a couple of years before the Great Depression actually started. So the chain of events were you had the stock market crash in 1929. It led to the Great Depression. In 1930, the United States imposes import restrictions, these things called the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. And then over the next couple of years, you had countries all around the world impose lots and lots of different sorts of import restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
But it also turns out that the Smoot-Hawley tariffs themselves weren't really the trigger for those other countries imposing their own trade restrictions. And so it also wasn't kind of a trigger for the trade war that ultimately erupted.
Huh. Well, let's go back just a little bit. What was the philosophy of the lawmakers who decided it was time to pass that bill?
So what they were trying to do at the time was to assist farmers in the United States that were suffering from low prices. The problem were that these farmers were also large exporters of their agricultural products, and so tariffs weren't actually going to end up helping them all that much. So it ended up being a pretty poorly designed policy even from the start.
Hmm. So as these tensions between the United States and other countries start heating up, what's the feeling in the United States? Did the lawmakers immediately feel that they had made a mistake? Were American companies revolting? What was the feeling like here?
I think the American economy quickly got overwhelmed with other events. Trade was not a huge share of the U.S. economy back then. And so while the tariffs didn't help matters, they weren't really a big part of the debate as the United States slid into the Great Depression and then had other bigger economic policy fish to fry, if you will, where you had, you know, sort of catastrophic monetary policy decisions being made. There wasn't any great sense that it should reverse these policies, but there wasn't a sense that they should pile on and add even more import restrictions as well.
So let's jump ahead then to 2018. Does this resemble 1930 at all?
Not yet. So part of what happened in response to the 1930s is after the Second World War, the United States, Great Britain, and a number of other countries built a brand new trading system to try to avoid the kind of mistakes and downward spiral of trade policy actions that we had seen arise in the 1930s. Mm. And so in 1947, they established this thing called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. It was a basic multilateral rules-based system for trade. It's essentially the same one that we live under today. Today it's called the World Trade Organization, but it's basically the same set of rules. And what these rules do is they provide a much fairer, much more non-discriminatory, and a transparent approach to trade policymaking. What we've seen happen so far with the Trump administration is potentially imposing new tariffs on products like steel and aluminum. These are worrisome, and they're going to be economically costly for the American economy. But so far, they're relatively small in scope. Mm. He's not raising tariffs over the entire U.S. economy, say. This is only about 2% of U.S. imports. And we also have procedures in place for other countries to respond to those kinds of trade policy actions today that we didn't have in the 1930s. So we're sort of just at the first step. It's worrisome what we're seeing so far, but I think we're still a far cry away from where we were in the 1930s.
Well, another big difference is the state of the economy. Smoot-Hawley in 1930 came after the stock market crash. You know, we're in the midst of an economic crisis in this country. In 2018, it's a very different picture. The economy is humming along. Does the state of the economy make a difference when you're thinking about these tariffs?
It does, but I would argue kind of in the opposite direction. And that is, you know, we really wouldn't expect to see major impulsive calls for import protection when the economy is doing relatively well, mm-hmm. as we're seeing right now. We do expect to see companies that have to compete with imports and they're suffering during a recession, say, to be much more likely to ask for protection. And so that's what is a little bit worrisome. If the economy were to somehow go into a downturn, we might end up seeing a lot more demands for the kinds of trade barriers that President Trump seems really interested in imposing. So the ones that he's imposing at the moment, in many instances, you know, aren't needed necessarily. They aren't being necessarily requested wholeheartedly by American industries and companies, especially when it comes to things like what he's proposing on automobiles. You know, there's really no call by the American automobile industry to ask for new tariffs. And so that is a little bit worrisome.
But the president has been talking about these tariffs ever since he was campaigning for the White House. And his trade advisor, Peter Navarro, said that you really can't compare what happened in the 1930s with what's happening today because, as he said, that was the first shot in the war, whereas this latest tariff is a defensive response to what other countries have been doing to the United States for years. Do you think there's any truth to that?
There's a very small grain of truth to the Trump administration's approach, and that is there is at the moment global overcapacity in the steel and aluminum industries, and that needs to be addressed. And some of that is coming out of excessive production expansion in China. But what's really problematic is the Trump administration's approach to dealing with that issue. They're potentially imposing tariffs under a trade law called Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. It's a national security law.
Right.
They're making the argument that they need to impose tariffs to protect American national security. That is not really a legitimate argument. When you look at the data, most of the steel that the United States imports does not come from China. It actually comes from our allies. The biggest sources are countries like Canada, the European Union, Mexico, Japan, South Korea. These are countries with which we have strategic military alliances and common defenses in many cases. So to say that stopping imports from those countries would somehow improve the American national security, I just think is an extremely bogus argument. It's not to say that there doesn't need to be something done about the underlying problem. It's just the approach that the Trump administration has taken to deal with that problem is really, really problematic.
Well, the president also says that trade wars are easy to win. He tweeted that last week. Is he right about that?
Absolutely not. There's no one who wins in a trade war in the country sense, at least. what is going to happen is trading partners are going to retaliate against the United States. So we're already seeing reports that the European Union is establishing the products that American companies and farmers currently send to Europe that it's preparing to retaliate over if the Trump administration goes ahead with this. A lot of these are products that have nothing to do with steel or aluminum. Mm. You know, it may be bourbon from Kentucky.
Harley-Davidson motorcycles.
Harley-Davidson. Right, or dairy products or blue jeans. And so if you're a worker in one of these companies, you're saying to yourself, wait a second, I'm not benefiting at all from these steel or aluminum tariffs. And not only am I not benefiting, but I'm going to be caught in the crossfire of President Trump's trade war. So no, there really are no winners in heading down this kind of path.
And what about 1930? Did we win that one?
No, in 1930, it was a complete disaster. Mm. In fact, I was just rereading my Peterson Institute colleague's, Doug Irwin, his book that's called Trade Policy Disaster, Lessons from the 1930s. I would highly recommend it. It was all countries lost. And this is what led to the broad agreement that we needed to do something different, that we needed to establish a new system to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. And that's why over the war period, even in the 1940s, there was really deep, intense discussions to develop a new system for trade that would prevent us from ever going back to what we did in the 1930s.
That's Chad Bown. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. He hosts the weekly podcast Trade Talks. Chad, thanks for the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
The women's basketball team at Tiny Grace University in Omaha, Nebraska, had a winning season and qualified for a regional postseason tournament that begins Wednesday. But this season is about a lot more than wins and losses for the Royals, because this is the end of the line for the team. Their school is closing in May. Mike Tobias from NET Nebraska reports.
All right. Tomorrow we have off. Today, let's really hit home on some stuff we can really work on from the past week, okay?
Coach Brandon Rogers is going easy on his team during this Wednesday night practice. They've just played four games in 5 days, including trips to Arkansas, Oklahoma, and South Dakota.
Hey, we're at 40. We can do it. Let's go. We're at 40.
For every big-money, high-profile college sports program, there's a tiny, low-profile Grace University. They compete in the National Christian College Athletic Association and have won a few championships over the years. Unlike their major conference neighbors, Grace Athletics doesn't have things like showers with heated floors, lockers with built-in iPads, charter jets to games. The Royals travel in a rented 15-passenger van. It's a small Christian college that started the season with a new young coach and big dreams.
Our goal is to get to regionals. Never been done since we've joined the Division I in the NCCAA, so we're excited. We're hungry.
Then came a Tuesday morning in October. Junior guard Loretta Gambo was at Daly Chapel with teammates, classmates, teachers. She remembers it was unusually packed, and she remembers what a school official told the crowd.
Then he announces, that it's closing at the end of the year.
It, meaning the school, Grace University, was shutting down.
Wait, what? No, I was supposed to graduate from here. I'm supposed to have, my 4 years of basketball here.
Blaming low enrollment and financial challenges, Grace decided to close its doors after this school year.
Obviously, that hit us all very out of the blue, and none of us expected that by any means.
Says junior forward Chida Johnson.
Some days are hard, and it's, this really sucks. What am I going to do next year? And helping each other through that, and then some days you joke about it, oh, our school is closing. What is going on? We make light of it.
Coach will park in two parking spots with our van on trips, be like, oh, it's okay, our school's closing.
It is dark humor, very dark humor.
They talk about it sometimes, hanging out in their coach's office, on trips. But most of the time, they're just college kids having fun and playing a game they love. Playing with a sense of responsibility to leave a lasting memory of Grace Athletics. Because now, they're the only team left on campus. Empty shelves and marks on the wall where pictures used to hang surround Sean Cleaver in his office. Cleaver was the men's basketball coach at Grace, but he never had a team this year. Closure led to canceling his season. Now he's trying to find new homes for his players. And he and a handful of other Grace Athletic staffers are doing something they've never done, trying to figure out how you end an athletic program.
Everybody wonders that because this is a first for everybody. You know, how do you close a school? How do you close a program? And we are figuring it out as we go because nobody's ever done this before.
Trophy cases line the walls outside Cleaver's office. So do memorabilia sign-up sheets.
People are signing up. We're giving out old uniforms, basketballs, and whatnot, just so people can have a piece of Grace that they can remember it in a positive way.
Cleaver played ball here, too, and coached the women's team for a while. His parents met here.
It is very sad, and it hits me at random moments.
So if you have a seal, she'll at least know a wraparound pass is there.
Women's coach Brandon Rogers and his Royals know more about their next game, their next opponent, than they do about next year. And they're okay with that.
It's something incredible because everyone's fighting for something right now. You know what I mean? We're fighting for next year, the unknown. We don't know what it is, but we all are doing it together.
His players are all sophomores and juniors. That means when Grace closes in May, they'll head different directions to finish school, some to keep playing ball. Right now, Marissa Brown, Loretta Gambo, Chida Johnson, and their teammates are bonded by basketball, faith, and a strange, stressful situation they take in stride.
It's just, there's nothing we can do to change it, so just enjoy the time we have now.
God is good. I know that he has a plan for it, and he's going to take care of all of us.
It's definitely brought us closer together, and now we really take every game to heart. And, you know, before we were all really looking forward to next season, and, oh, yeah, this season is great, but next season will be even better, and now there is no next season.
But there are a few more practices and tournament games.
All right, bring it in.
A few more chances to make lasting memories, the stories of funny things on long bus trips that linger a lot longer than game scores.
Let's finish on a good note. Hey, big things coming. We're at 7. Let's keep rolling.
Let's go.
A last chance to make the last chapter of Grace University sports history a good one.
Family on 3. 1, 2, 3.
Family!
For Here and Now, I'm Mike Tobias in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.